is a crucial week in Springfield, as we're now literally days away from the May 31st budget deadline. How are prospects looking for a compromise? Governor Rauner said yesterday he knows it can get done in the next 9 days.
We'll continue to negotiate. We'll work in good faith for as long as it takes.
The governor says he stands ready, but added he cannot and will not sign an unbalanced budget into law. We'll talk about what's ahead this week in the State House. Also, virtual medical help is being used more and more across Illinois, especially to help rural patients connect with specialists. Today, we ask, how does Illinois stack up when compared to other states?
I was trying to figure out why it was in all these other states telehealth moved forward at rapid pace, and Illinois is one of the last ones.
It's Illinois telehealth expert Nancy Kasak on Tech Access TV. We speak with her, patients, and doctors about the issue. That's all this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We know that with certain medical conditions, timing is crucial. Take a stroke. If it's not diagnosed and treated within hours, patients can have very different results. Today on the 21st, we're talking about how telemedicine, that's a catch-all term for virtual connections patients can make with doctors, is changing this issue. We're going to talk about how patients at small hospitals are using telemedicine to link with specialists all over the country and how it's helping rural healthcare across Illinois. Let's start with Bob Denton, who suffered a stroke in 2014. He lives 100 miles away from a neurologist in Springfield, but was able to get a near-immediate assessment of his condition thanks to the telestroke program at St. John's Hospital in Springfield, which is where he's joining us right now from the doctor's office. Hey, Bob, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you.
I wonder, Bob, if you can walk us through the day you had your stroke back in October 2014. I know you woke up and you took a shower, but then as you were getting dressed, something didn't feel right. What happened?
I couldn't make my right arm move like I wanted. I got back to the table, but I was knocking the chairs over trying to get to sit down, and that woke my wife up. And that's kind of how they found me.
And I know that then the ambulance then took you to St. Anthony's Memorial Hospital in Effingham. Is that just a few minutes away from your house?
Yes, I'm only 5 miles from Effingham.
But I know you needed to speak with what you needed was a neurologist who's based in Springfield. So just for everyone knowing the distance there, that's 100 miles away. Now, instead of driving, the healthcare team wheeled in what's called a telestroke robot, so you could speak face-to-face with the doctor through the computer screen. Do you remember what that was like?
Oh, well, I could see him, and he could see me, and he would instruct him to turn it different directions so he could see what I looked like. And by that time, I was getting my vision back in my right eye and my feeling back in my right arm. But I think he could get a better vision on what was happening to me at the time.
And was he asking you specific, do you remember if he was asking you, I guess he was probably asking you specific questions like, just to try to gauge what your condition was?
Yes, he asked me several questions. They were going to use a new medicine, but I had had some work done before, and they couldn't use it, so they had to revert to something else.
And they started treating you immediately, and I know this was back in 2014. Bob, how's your recovery been since then?
It's great. I do whatever I want to do. The only problems I have now is short-term memory.
Bob, we really appreciate you coming on and sharing your story. Thank you so much for being with us.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to bring two more people into the conversation. On the line from Springfield is Dr. Gurpreet Mander. He's the chief medical officer at St. John's Hospital in Springfield, where, as you just heard, Bob was, he's chair of the Illinois Telehealth Network. He oversees a telemedicine program that helped connect Bob in Effingham with that neurologist in Springfield 100 miles away. Dr. Mander, thanks for being with us on the 21st.
Good morning, though. Thanks for having me on.
Also with us on the line from Chicago is Nancy Kasak, director of the Illinois Telehealth Health Initiative. Nancy, welcome to the 21st as well.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Dr. Mander, we just heard Bob share his story. There was that 100 miles would have been hours, obviously, before he could have been seen by a neurologist. Dr. Mander, can you help us understand why with a stroke in particular, an immediate evaluation by a neurologist is so critical?
Yeah, I definitely can. So, you know, strokes are pretty large public health problem in the United States, and there is a difference or a discrepancy between the care we give patients with stroke versus what the standard of care is. And the main reason behind that is an immediate access to specialists who can diagnose, evaluate, and initiate treatment. So, you know, the American Heart Association has actually approved the use of telemedicine in stroke. You know, time is brain. So if it's not treated in a timely fashion, your brain cells start dying and get injured. So, and the earlier you intervene, the higher, better the chances of recovery. So that's the reason we need to treat that immediately.
Mm-hmm. And how long has this telemedicine, this telestroke program, been in existence for you all at St. John's?
It's a little above 2.5 years.
And how many hospitals are you connected with throughout Illinois?
We are connected with 12 regional sites through our hub site, which is St. John's Hospital, HSHS St. John's Hospital in Springfield.
Mm-hmm. And is it literally how we were describing it with Bob's experience, where roll a screen out, I guess?
Definitely. The way that works is that if a patient presents in one of our rural emergency rooms with symptoms of stroke, they call our 1-800 in line, which is our access line, and initiate the stroke protocol. And within about 10 to 15 minutes, the robot is activated, and a neurologist is able to evaluate the patient. You know, they walk you through certain examination. They talk to you, make you move your arms, legs, and then with the help of the local physician or the nurse, they complete an examination. They're able to review the CAT scans, which have already been done and ordered as per standardized protocols, and review the patient's history, and then come up with a treatment plan in a timely fashion.
So there's also, obviously, an admitting physician or a nurse who's physically in the room with the patient as the doctor remotely is also going through things.
Correct. It's the local emergency room physician, usually, with the help of the local nursing staff.
And when, as you mentioned, stroke is the third leading cause of death, and I know that there's been systematic reviews of studies that have found these telestroke services have reduced mortality, and as you said, it's been approved by the AMA. I imagine some people, though, might be thinking, is this as good as an in-person visit? What's your response to that?
It is. I think, in fact, one of the most mature programs in telehealth and telemedicine is stroke. Been in existence for a long time, and there are large studies both out of Europe, Canada, and the U.S., which support early access and a timely evaluation by a neurologist leads to the same outcomes, as in-person examination. And probably a more important thing is the risk of complications by the use of the clot-busting medication. That's also the same as in-person versus telemedicine. So, it has helped save lives, also helped us with timely initiation of the clot-busting medication, TPA, and or, if need, referral for an intervention. And it has been shown to improve long-term outcomes, neurological outcomes, and decrease institutionalization. So.
That's Dr. Gurpreet Mander. He's the chief medical officer at St. John's Hospital in Springfield. He's chair of the Illinois Telehealth Network. We're talking about telemedicine right now on the 21st and how it's particularly helping rural health care across Illinois. If you have questions or comments, as always, you can join us. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can tweet to 21st Show, 21ST Show. And on the line with us as well from Chicago is Nancy Kasek, director of the Illinois Telehealth Initiative. Nancy, as we're listening to this particular way that telemedicine is being used, I wonder if you can take a step back and define for us what exactly we mean when we say telemedicine. That's a very specific program, but I imagine there's lots of other ways hospitals and patients and doctors are using this.
Absolutely. The easiest way for me to describe is that it's a way of connecting providers to patients and providers to other providers using telecommunications. And so it could be everything from interactive video, it could be computer connections. It could be monitoring devices. It's just taking advantage of technology to cut the time down, you know, in terms of providing care, improve the access to care, and also reduce cost of care, which is obviously a big issue not only for patients but for health systems.
Mm-hmm. And how else are people using telemedicine then?
Well, nationally, it's spectacular what they're doing. But in Illinois, the things that have sort of jumped out at me as being particularly great are not only the great work of the HSHS system and other telestroke networks, but also in mental health. Mental health is a prime example of where you could provide easy mental health care. So, you know, a child is having an incident at school, the school says you should go to the community mental health clinic. By and large, the kids never make it to the mental health clinic. And in many states...
Why is that?
Because of the intimidation, the stigma of going to a community mental health clinic, the delay in getting access to a mental health provider there, and just, you know, sort of kids are kids, right? And they don't do things right away, and the situation, the urgency changes after, you know, time passes, and they don't make it there. But in other states, they have, like right next to the nurse's station, they'll have a room there with no label on the door or anything, but it's just a room where they can go in and talk to somebody to provide mental health care by interactive video, and right then and there. And it's spectacular. And then kids around the state, but particularly in rural communities, need access to mental health providers. And 90% of the state of Illinois is a mental health provider deficiency area. So we have to be able to figure out ways of doing this. Sometimes what happens now is if a child is told to that they need to see a child psychiatrist, child psychiatrists are pretty much in the Chicago area. I mean, probably 95% of them are in the Chicago area. If you're downstate, what it means is that the child needs to take a day off from school, parent needs to take a day off from work, and then they need to travel to the city of Chicago, where they go into an office where the child is intimidated by not being in his comfortable space or her comfortable space, and they don't open up as much. But it has been proven around the country that what happens in all sorts of studies is that if you provide telemental health care in a secure setting, in a prompt setting for the child, they open up. They love talking to a doc in a box. You know, that's what they're used to, having interactions, you know, with interactive video on their phones and on their computers, and they're used to it, and they open up, like, wonderfully, and you don't have the time delay and the cost that involved with it.
Nancy, I know under former Governor Quinn, you were in charge of the Illinois Governor's Telehealth Working Group. I wonder from your perspective with that, as well as now with your work with the Telehealth Initiative, how do you think Illinois ranks compared to other states when accessing this and providing telemedicine?
Well, I can tell you this, Illinois is not a leader. In spite of the spectacular things that Dr. Martyr and Dr. Bockhaus at Carle Foundation are doing and other people are doing in the state, we're not a leader in this.
And why?
It took me 5 or 6 years to figure this out. You know, I couldn't figure it out at first. But finally what happened is I realized that it's the highly competitive healthcare market. Healthcare systems right now are fighting for the last dollar. They don't want to take any risks. And they're going through a lot of transition. But what you can see is that states around the United States are just blossoming in their use of telehealth. And Illinois is, I think, really waking up to it right now.
Well, and one other question, and Dr. Mander, I want to bring you back into this conversation about the competitive stuff. But before we get to that, Nancy, I know 21 states require private insurers to cover video visits. Is Illinois one of them?
No, it is not. It's one of the 13 states where there's no mandatory requirement, nor is there any practice. In some states, they don't even need to pass a state law that requires that there be reimbursement because the insurers say, this makes sense.
Pass a law here, then, for this to happen in Illinois?
Well, that's an issue. I mean, you know, it's the issue as to how you set this up, but it certainly should be part of the conversation. I mean, the big issue we have in Illinois is that at this time, the primary insurance company that dominates the healthcare market is Blue Cross Blue Shield of Illinois, and they do not have a practice of reimbursing for telehealth. But there are other new insurers coming in. Cigna and I heard Anthem from Indiana is going to be coming into Illinois when they purchase. Cigna, Aetna, United Health, they're all reimbursing for telehealth in various ways. Medicare reimburses for it in rural communities, and Medicaid reimburses for it right now.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes that. I think that explains a lot for people. Dr. Mandard, what about to Nancy's point about the competitive nature? Because as we said, your telehealth program at St. John's in Springfield, you're working with more than 20 hospitals all across the state, and you're connecting people. How did you convince competitor hospitals to come on board and collaborate with you guys?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I think just to follow up on Nancy's points, you know, the lack of parity in payment is definitely a big barrier in implementing telehealth across Illinois. And there are some bills which have gone back and forth in front of the local state legislator. And, you know, we need all the advocacy we can to support that effort, because I think that'll be a big game changer once we're able to reimburse, you know, providers and hospitals and entities to provide these services. Now, what we are doing through the Illinois Telehealth Network is actually in parallel with our HSHS telemedicine initiatives. We felt that, you know, when we got into this about several years ago, we noticed that A, there was a lack of knowledge among various hospitals, and B, and individuals, and also there was a lack of resources to invest in, especially with the smaller rural hospitals, the critical access hospitals. So our thought was that maybe can we bring people together? Can we bring different organizations, you know, our own hospitals, plus hospitals who might be with competitors for the common good, and to work on a common cause and look at telemedicine as a shared resource with the greater good in mind? You know, given that we serve a rural population, we most of our hospitals in the region are in health shortage areas where there's lack of providers and specialists. So with that in mind, we went forth and got the concept of the Illinois Telehealth Network. The best way to put it is it was just old-fashioned communication and relationships which we had built up with our regional hospitals through our transfer center by providing services over the years. We just reached out to them, to their CEOs and their leaders, discussed the concept, and we brought everybody together.
Dr. Mender, I'm going to stop you there because we're going to have to take a break. But when we come back, we're going to continue this conversation. I want to find out a little bit more about that. And we're also going to be joined by Carl Hospital as well. So stay tuned. We're talking about telemedicine here on the 21st.
The 21st is made possible by the Library at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, fostering discovery by providing information curation and archival services to extend scholarly impact from Urbana-Champaign to the state, the nation, and the world. The University Library at Illinois.
Welcome to the 21st. Welcome back. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about telemedicine and some of the ways it can improve access and cut costs, especially in rural areas across the state. Stefan Robinson is on the line with us from Madison, Illinois. He's the former director of the telehealth program at UIC Hospital. Stefan, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you have many years' experience working in telemedicine, but the larger reason we wanted to have you on the show today is about 6 months ago, you suffered a stroke. Can you tell us what happened?
Well, I'm an athlete, and I'm actually 50 years old this year, but I'm an athlete, and was playing a basketball game. After that game, I suffered a stroke and presented at one of the local hospitals here, and just did not receive adequate care, essentially, for the condition. And certainly, if there had been access to telestroke services, to reach out to one of the tertiary care centers, then certainly I think the outcomes would have been better.
And I understand your wife was with you at the ER, was speaking to the hospital staff, saying because it wasn't clear to the staff or they didn't believe that you were having a stroke.
Right.
Now, go ahead.
It's a protocol that's FAST. And unfortunately, because of my stroke, I don't remember what the acronym stands for. But FAST, the protocol needs to be it needs to be applied at the time the patient's there, and a decision made as to whether or not the patient should be moved to a stroke center. And it just didn't happen in my case, and so and it was just an unfortunate situation.
And just to be clear, you were in Chicago at this point, right?
No, I play in the southern suburbs of Chicago, so around, I believe that hospital, well, it's near Madison, Illinois.
Okay, so you were in the hospital, so it was southern suburbs. And
yeah.
I'm not, earlier in the show, we spoke to another stroke patient, and he lives in Effingham, but because of the telemedicine program, he was able to get an assessment by a neurologist immediately. At what point were you able to see a neurologist, because there wasn't one on site at your hospital? When were you finally able to see one?
About 12 hours later, there is a neurologist that arrived around 11 a.m. I actually arrived at the hospital that night at 10:30 p.m., and so I saw a neurologist the next day around 11 a.m.
Mm-hmm. And how has your recovery been?
So the challenges with stroke is after a period of time, and I believe that amount of time is 3 hours, 3.5 hours, something like that, 4 hours, where they have an opportunity to intervene and provide some type of a clot-busting drug or try to alleviate the clot. So that didn't happen. Can you repeat the question once more for me?
Well, I just was wondering, in terms of your symptoms, how that sort of affected how it's affected your life right now.
Okay, so in terms of the way it's affected my life, it's really more memory-based. And so having had the stroke, I forget things quickly. After that fourth hour or so, whatever you've experienced at that time is, I believe, what you've got going forward. And so for a lot of people, that's paralysis, and that's really something that I had early on, drooping mouth and inability to see from one side of your face or the eye, in my case, the right eye. And so some of those things have come back, I guess is what I want to say. Some of those things have come back. And so I've regained a lot of my movement, but my memory is where the challenge lies. And so you can imagine how that affects my life and ability to work and things of that sort.
Mm-hmm. What kind of work did you? You used to be a sports broadcaster. What kind of work are you? Are you able to do that still?
So I've doing that was something I did on the side. I broadcasted Royal men's basketball games. Did color analysis for them for the past 5 years, and I did do some of those games. I don't think I was very good at it, quite honestly. But more especially, one of the things that was very frustrating to me was that while I was doing those games, I was unable to remember the players' names, and they would be right in front of me. And so, there were some challenges that I hoped to work through, and I got through the broadcast, but I knew that I wasn't in good form, in good shape.
Mm.
Now, what I did primarily until June of last year was I worked at UIC, University of Illinois at Chicago, for 16 years in various roles. But the past 6 years, I've been the administrative director of telehealth. You know, we started that program, and so I understood the benefits of telemedicine programs, telehealth programs, but more especially telestroke and the ability to connect the patient with physician, especially since the amount of time that patient has is limited and fleeting.
Mm-hmm. I want to bring a couple more folks into this conversation. We're speaking with Stefan Robinson, as he said, a member of the Planning Committee for the Illinois Telehealth Law Forum. Previously, we've been speaking with Dr. Gurpreet Mander. He's the Chief Medical Officer at St. John's Hospital in Springfield, Illinois. In studio with me is Harry Brockes. He's the CEO of Carl Hoopson Regional Health Center. He's the vice president of regional health for Carl. Thanks for being with us, Harry.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Mander and Harry, both of you, as you're listening to this story, I wonder, Dr. Mander, if we could start with you. You said there were 20 hospitals, and it's an interesting thing as we're hearing Stefan's story, because he was actually in the suburbs of Chicago, and I think, well, if you're in the city, you have more access. And Dr. Mander, have you found that that's not necessarily the case?
Definitely not. I mean, access doesn't necessarily mean that rural areas will have worse access, and you see these issues in large cities, too, with some of the smaller hospitals. The Illinois Telehealth Network is, we are partnering with about 23 entities in southern and central Illinois, few of which are large medical groups, to deploy shared telehealth services across the region. And stroke and acute care is just one element of telehealth. You know, there are opportunities in behavioral health, which has already been mentioned by Nancy, because there's there's a big shortage of mental health providers, plus, of course, the stigma associated with that. But beyond that, there's also a shortage of various other specialists in most of rural hospitals some of city hospitals, too, in underserved areas. And telehealth is one of the solutions which can be used to provide access to patients. But I think one need to understand that telehealth is not just about acute care. It's also about routine care. In fact, if you look at it, about 70% of your clinic visits to a doctor do not actually require you to be in the clinic. So they could be provided remotely. Same thing for urgent care visits, which is another program which one of our partner groups has launched, is to provide tele-virtual care, urgent care visits, where you can, if you have a cold or a cough, you can talk to a doctor, get evaluated, and see if it's necessary for you to go to the emergency room. So there are several applications of telehealth, you know, right from the spectrum of an electronic ICU, which is 24/7 monitoring, to asynchronous, you know, evaluation where you can send a picture of a rash to a doctor and he can evaluate and give you some advice. So those are the various applications.
And Harry, as CEO of this regional health center, for context for folks, Carle Foundation Hospital is based in Champaign-Urbana. I understand that more than 90% of the 1.3 million patients that use Carle services live in rural counties. Is that correct?
That's correct. Everywhere from south of I-80 all the way down to the Kentucky border are patients that we care for either in trauma events, because we're the only trauma center in this region, or in our NICU, which is our neonatal intensive care for babies that are born premature. So these types of services are very important to emergency rooms in those regional areas. Just like the example you've given with stroke here, I can tell you an example in Hoopston where we had a baby come with a simple rash, but the ER doctor really wasn't used to seeing it and wasn't sure what to do with the child, but we were able to use telemedicine to have a pediatrician come on the line, diagnose the rash, send the mom to CVS and get some cream versus taking a two-hour trip.
And how often is that, and we heard Dr. Mander say this as well, it's not just for acute care, for emergency care, but also for routine care. How important is telemedicine to what you all are doing at Carle?
Oh, absolutely. It's a huge platform for us moving forward, and it's not just about routine care. It's about preventative care, too. Three platforms we utilize. Obviously, we use it in our emergency rooms with our Rural Alliance partners. We have five hospitals across the region that we partner with in emergency rooms to provide access to specialists during emergency needs. But just like Dr. Mander was saying, you can go to our clinics and see a neurologist, an endocrinologist, an OBGYN. It all can be done through a telemedicine connection for a follow-up visit. Let's say you came to Carle and you had a heart attack and you ended up having bypass surgery, but you need to have follow-up visits in the clinic after that. A little troubling to have to drive an hour to an hour and a half to get back over to the doctor's office just for a 20-minute visit. So we can actually do those visits right there, which increases compliance of the patient because they're likely to cancel that visit an hour and a half away, more likely to go if it's in their local clinic. And then the other platform is e-visits, right? So we can actually engage the patient through a MyCarle platform where they can simply contact us on an e-visit and say, this is what's going on and I need some help. And that'll go to a doctor and he'll make a diagnosis within 4 hours.
And so that's through, when you say contact through an e-visit, that's sending an email or going into your website, or is it also actually even maybe doing a video chat or a conversation with a doctor virtually?
Right. Today, our e-visit platform is based out of Epic, which is our electronic medical record. And you would actually go into your MyCarle website using Epic and go through there to send an email to the doctor. We're always working towards things like the instant doc on a phone type program. Those are the up and coming technologies. But I think even more important, Nyla, moving forward, is how we use this to prevent problems in the future, right? People who have cardiac congestive heart failure, they tend to gain weight quickly and end up in the emergency rooms with acute exacerbations because they're holding fluid in their body. There's actually technology out there now that we can put a scale in their home. That scale they weigh themselves every morning. The scale transmits that to their doctor every day. And the doctor sees a 5-pound gain in weight overnight. He knows there's a problem. The nurse contacts the patient and says, you've gained 5 pounds overnight. Maybe take an extra dose of medication. Or in some situations, we send somebody out to the house to give them a little extra medication.
And you're actually doing that right now?
We're not doing that now.
Okay.
That's where our plans are going.
That's
where our plans are going.
Before we get to the time frame from implementation for something like that, do you have a sense of what percentage of Carle patients are using electronic services like this now?
Yeah, we're up to about 50% of our patients are using a MyCarle account. So they're accessing their accounts through our MyCarle Epic Access. And we've only used about, in terms of e-visits, we've done about 140 so far this year. That number has continued to grow each year, and you'll start to see us market it more and talk more about it. And one of the things Nancy talked about that we've done with our e-visit platform is a lot of places, you know, are concerned about whether their commercial insurance wants to pay for it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in many cases, an e-visit, we just charge $20 flat fee. And that's really about the same as what your copay would be if you went to the doctor itself. So that's what you're going to pay out of pocket anyway.
And but that means it's an interest. If you're doing it that way, you guys are probably losing money on it? Or are you just thinking this is a cost-effective way to bring people into the system and you're going to recoup the costs in another way?
It's a cost-effective way to manage care. Doctors are a shortage in America. They're going to be a shortage in America for the next 20 years. Access to doctors and other providers is extremely prevalent. So if you have a simple condition that you can use an e-visit platform, that's great. It saves the actual office time for somebody who maybe has a more urgent, more timely need.
I'm speaking with Harry Brockes. He's the CEO of Carl Hubson Regional Health Center. On the line with us from Springfield is Dr. Gupreet Mander. He's with St. John's Hospital, where he's the chief medical officer there. And this is my question for both of you. And Dr. Mander, if you want to start, and then Harry, sure. If you can weigh in. When you're thinking particularly, I'm thinking about particularly maybe older patients who may not be as used to, you know, we heard Nancy saying earlier for kids from a mental health perspective, kids who have sort of grown up in a digital generation and FaceTiming and Skyping, it's a very comfortable thing for them to have a digital conversation with someone. Do you have, is there a lot of education or is there resistance or work that you all have to do with maybe an older population that may not be as open to this?
Well, actually, we haven't seen that problem with our stroke network or our telehealth pathways. We found to be fairly receptive. You do need to go through an educational process for anyone, for that matter, who's going to be interacting with a doctor through a video conferencing or using, a USB port-attached ultrasounds or echoes. But patients adopt to that. I think what patients really like is having that one-on-one relationship with a specialist within a short period of time. Gives them more, makes them more comfortable. Gives them the sense that they're being cared for. We have not in general perceived that issue. And similarly with our telehealth pathway, which is similar to what was being mentioned, we've had a successful program through pericardiovascular for almost 14 years called the telescale program, where we do remote monitoring of heart failure. That has been an extremely successful program, and most of those patients are elderly and individual. Hmm. So, the short answer to your question is no. But, yes, you have to go through an educational process for anyone, for that matter, because it is a different way of delivering medicine. But as you see the younger generation, the millennials coming on, they are very comfortable with that, video interaction, and using electronic methods.
Harry, how about for Carl?
Yeah, I would say very similar response. Most of the time when we've had patients come in that are older, they get a little bit hesitant at first, but once they get in the room with the nurse and the doctor comes on the line and they realize that there's a digital stethoscope, there's a digital optoscope, so the doctor's seeing all the things he would see as if he was there in the room anyway, they get real comfortable real quick. And especially in the areas of mental health that Nancy talked about earlier, it has been the most successful program because people like that idea of privacy. They're not walking into a mental health center. They're kind of just going into a regular doctor's office and nobody knows why they're really there.
For Carl Foundation or for Carl Hospitals, Harry, I wonder how you see, you've mentioned ways you'd like to see this expand. What are the biggest challenges right now for your expansion in doing telemedicine?
Right. Well, technologies are still developing, right? Some of the sensors that are being developed today are still very expensive. They're still not quite as accurate as you'd like them to be, but they're making exponential leaps every year. And I think over the next 5 years, you're going to see a dramatic movement to keeping patients more outside of the hospital than in the hospital. That's the way healthcare is moving today and being more preventative. The state just took an action with their mobile integrated health network, which is now going to allow non-emergent visits to the home by EMTs or nurses, which weren't allowed before. It's going to allow us to change the way we provide care and really be more proactive and building about community health. We're going to talk about community health in the future versus taking care of acute issues. And these devices like peak flow meters that can tell us when an asthmatic is having a bad day, glucose monitors that send a message to your phone and say your sugar is too high, and we send a message to your doctor, it's going to change the way we provide care. And it's an exciting time to be in healthcare because we're really going to talk about compliance and the patient's engagement and how they care for themselves.
And do you think this will really change the way we do rural healthcare as well then?
Absolutely. The access to this type of information is critical to making healthier communities in our rural areas.
We have less than a minute left, but really quickly, what else do you all need? What does Carl need to continue to do this kind of work?
Well, we need to continue to see legislative support for it at the federal and state levels. We need to see places like Blue Cross that Nancy talked about earlier jump on board and say we're going to reimburse for these types of things. That'll make patients more comfortable using them. And we just need more education. We need to get the word out to patients more and more.
That's Harry Brockes, Vice President of Regional Health for Carl Foundation, CEO of Carl Hubson Regional Health Center. Thanks to Harry as well as to Dr. Mander with St. John's Hospital in Springfield.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll be talking state politics in Springfield. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. On Mondays at this time, we talk Illinois politics, and what a week we've got ahead of us in the State House. We're facing a pretty big deadline. That's May 31st. That's next Tuesday for the budget situation. My guest today, Chris Kjærgaard, is a political reporter with the Peoria Journal-Star. He's joining us from Peoria. Hey, Chris.
Hi there.
And Brian Mackey is on the line with us from WUIS in Springfield, where he covers state government and politics. Brian, welcome back to The 21st.
Hey, Nyla.
Now, let's start with this weekend, because part of what we like to do is catch folks up on what happened over the weekend. And I think we saw a lot of Governor Rauner this weekend, so I thought we could play a little bit of it because we heard him talk about things on Saturday, and then we heard a different conversation from him on Sunday. Saturday was the GOP state convention in Peoria. Let's hear Governor's words at the GOP convention.
We're going to bring in the resources and put together the biggest ground game that's ever been done for legislative races in Illinois history. And we are going to pick up seats against the corrupt Chicago machine and Madigan's Democrats. We are going to pick up seats.
So that was Saturday, promising to defeat Democrats this fall. Then yesterday, the governor had a message. He was ready to work with said Democrats on the almost 11-month-long budget impasse.
We'll continue to negotiate. We'll work in good faith for as long as it takes.
So talking about compromise as well, let's break down first and start with Chris. Let's start with that GOP convention. What was the atmosphere like for this GOP state convention in Peoria this weekend?
Well, it was a very red meat kind of convention with all the fist pumping, foot stomping kind of speeches that you tend to expect from those types of affairs between the governor, the comptroller, much of the statewide Republican delegation in Congress, though interestingly not Senator Kirk, but all of them got up and gave very impassioned speeches, either about need for change at the federal level or, in most cases, need for change at the state level. There were a number of videos to jazz up the audience that were very anti-Madigan, anti-Springfield. So the mood was very much a fire up the troops.
And one of the biggest things that got people fired up, Chris, was the idea emphasizing the definition of marriage as between one man and one woman as a key part of the GOP platform. How much of that was a conversation this weekend?
That dominated the conversation throughout the weekend, from the discussions at the platform committee throughout the day on Friday about that, and obviously those who were opposed to the proposal that came out of the platform committee for a change in that language in the party platform that would have acknowledged different types of marriage besides one man, one woman, which also would have emphasized religious freedom planks to the platform, met some serious opposition. Folks who were opposed to that change, who wanted to retain the one-man, one-woman language, absolutely leapt into action. There were buttons they were handing out.
People were even booing people who were saying, look, we need to appeal to younger voters, and this is not for younger voters. This is something that the notion of marriage as one man and one woman is going to leave us out of a lot of conversations.
Right, right. I was a little surprised at the vitriol there, coming from opponents of that change, who very aggressively interrupted the two speakers who were in favor of it, and you did not see that happening in the other direction.
And I know that the primary Donald Trump supporter who spoke at this GOP convention wasn't actually even from Illinois. So I'm curious about news with delegates like Todd Ricketts, as in the Cubs family Ricketts, for folks who are not familiar. We saw news this weekend. He's spending a lot of money on anti-Trump ads. What was the feeling from delegates there? Because they're bound to vote for Trump, at least in the first round of balloting when we get to the national GOP convention this summer.
They are, and it was interesting because and a number of speakers referenced the fact that, we've come out of a very divisive primary on the Republican side, and they were very, very clearly trying to emphasize unity. And you could see people making the turn in some of their rhetoric, some more slowly than others, with the, certainly the governor and several of those who are either statewide or are in Congress, not mentioning Trump by name, but rather pledging to support the ticket. Others, though, were very, very much trying to remind people that that Trump will be the nominee and will require the support from rank and file party members. So if folks are trying to bring together their party and trying to instill some unity there.
That's Chris Kjærgaard with Peoria Journal Star joining us as well from WUIS in Springfield, Brian Mackey. Brian, I wonder if you can remind us, Governor Rauner's, what he said about Donald Trump. And it sort of seems like everyone's kind of walking. We've got Illinois Republicans walking a very careful tightrope here when it comes to Donald Trump as the Republican nominee.
You know, it's funny because what the governor has said about Donald Trump is very similar to what he has said about same-sex marriage, which is as little as possible. He was asked about Trump earlier this year and some of the specific comments that Trump had made. This was around the time that Trump was slow to disavow a Klansman's endorsement. And the governor was very critical of that. However, he also said he'll support the ticket. And every time it's come up since then, he tries to change the conversation. Likewise with same-sex marriage. It's just not something he wants to talk about because, it distracts from what I think he views as his core issues. On the other hand, I don't think voters are going to have a hard time remembering that Donald Trump is at the or seems to be heading for the top of the Republican ticket. We've already had Democratic campaigns out there. Congresswoman Duckworth, for example, who's running against Senator Mark Kirk. Some people who back her are constantly putting out press releases that say the Kirk-Trump agenda or the Trump-Kirk agenda. So Republicans will be tied to Trump if the Democrats have their way.
Brian, how did Governor Rauner handle all of the conversations about same-sex marriage? As Chris was saying, a lot of the, as he was a little surprised at some of the vitriol that was directed towards the notion of same-sex marriage and that marriage should be between one man and one woman. Governor Rauner's always been pretty quiet on this. So how did he handle it this weekend?
Yeah, and again, I should say I was not there myself, but from what I've seen in the coverage, he avoided it, as he always has. And this is something that one of the most pointed examples of this actually happened a couple of years ago. He was still running. There was an editorial board meeting at the Chicago Tribune, and they broadcast this live on the web. And you could see the board members really just asking him, what do you think about same-sex marriage? And at this point, I believe it was already the law in Illinois. And he said, I think the voters should decide. And they said, well, what do you believe in your heart? What do you think? It doesn't matter. I think the voters should decide. And he just steadfastly refused to take a stand on it. And I think it's a good example of his approach to political communication, which is if something is not in his interest, he can be very disciplined about just really working very hard to avoid the topic, not take a stand, not alienate, as you pointed out, what is still a very key and significant constituency in the Republican Party that feels very strongly about this topic.
Let's talk about what Governor Rauner has taken a very clear stand on, which is we heard him say again. So we heard sort of his, firing up the troops on Saturday. Hey, we're going to take Speaker Madigan down. And then we heard him say yesterday, look, I'm ready to compromise. Republican leadership, Republican members are ready to compromise on this budget situation. We're almost 11 months now into the budget impasse. But he also said, I'm ready, but listen, I'm not going to sign, and this is what we've heard him say consistently, an unbalanced budget into law. So where are we with this, Brian? I mean, can you set up what we've got ahead of us this week? And basically, we've got 9 days here, right?
Yeah, and I mean, we've gone hundreds and hundreds of days without a budget in Illinois, and really, this deadline this week is somewhat of an artificial marker. I mean, Illinois is now going on a year without a balanced, without any sort of official state budget. There's been these piecemeal pieces of legislation. The schools, K through 12 schools got their funding. There was a little bit of a patch for higher education that came through. Now, lawmakers have also passed a sort of patch to give a little bit of something to the social service agencies that they contract with to take care of some of our most vulnerable people in this state. But, you know, in terms of an overall budget, the governor is still saying it has to be tied to his pro-business, anti-union or union-weakening agenda.
And, well, can I ask you about the social services, Brian? Because that bill, he has, I think he's technically, he has 60 days from May 18th to sign that bill to fund social services. Is he waiting first to see if there's a budget deal, or do we know what's happening with those social service funding, that stopgap funding?
Well, far be it from me to know what is in the governor's mind, but it does seem that, I mean, there have been some indications that he has concerns about this. Certainly his press shop has put out, called various portions of this legislation into question. They said there were drafting errors. Democrats will come back and say, oh, no, we left, you know, those aren't errors. We put that in the language of the bill to make sure that the money is not misspent on something other than social service. I won't get into the details of that. But, you know, the governor has indicated some reluctance about this. And really, this goes back years. The governor has talked about social service spending, human service spending, as a point of leverage over the Democrats. He has said that he viewed it as a wedge issue where he hoped he could get Democrats to kind of choose. Do you want to support government employee unions and the labor movement in general, or do you want to fund social services? And Democrats so far have refused to sort of be boxed into making that choice. And here we are, how many months later, without an official state budget?
Chris, I wonder where Peoria lawmakers stand in all of this, where you're sort of seeing the sense of what conversations are happening in Peoria around the budget impasse.
Well, for the most part, area lawmakers have stuck with their delegations, and we're interesting in that we have members in House Republicans, House Democrats, Senate Republicans, Senate Democrats out of Peoria. They have all pretty carefully hewed to their particular partisan affiliation, with some limited exceptions to that, because we have some state facilities here that have caused some concerns over closures, and we do have one Democratic lawmaker who's been very outspoken about the need to begin to talk about reforms to the workers' compensation system, and has really kind of been pushing that as what she hopes will be a solution. But as far as concrete action or concrete proposals, there really have not been many. Everybody here seems to be following the leader, more or less.
Well, and as you say that, everyone following the leader, I wonder how significant, Brian, you found the note, the language. Governor Rauner said, look, I think rank and file Democrats also want to move towards compromise. And I think that's an allusion to the different working groups that have been happening. Brian, what's been going on with all of these different working groups we've seen where we hear this term rank and file, i.e. not the leadership of people who are trying to resolve this budget situation?
Well, I personally think we need to be cautious with that, because that is part of the governor's message. He wants to portray this as big bad Speaker Michael Madigan, the Democratic Speaker of the House, as, you know, and the one of the governor's favorite lines is Speaker Madigan and the politicians he controls, right? So he wants to make it seem as though there's this divide, and that if only Mike Madigan didn't have his thumb on the Democratic politicians, they would do the right thing and pass his agenda. I think that Democrats have some real deep philosophical differences with the governor over issues like workers' compensation, over whether how free and open or restrictive our court system should be in terms of injury lawsuits and that sort of thing. And labor and trial lawyers, those are core members of the Democratic Party. They're not Democrats don't view them as special interests the way the governor does. They view them as their brethren.
Right.
And so I think that you have a situation where, you know, the governor wants to make it seem as though it's Speaker Madigan pulling the strings. But I think a lot of Democrats have questions about these things. And even if they would agree on changes to workers' compensation and the tort law system, which I think is possible. I don't think they like the idea of doing it sort of at gunpoint. I mean, maybe that's probably overstating it, but, you know, the governor has, as we said, the governor has talked about using this funding as a point, and he won't negotiate on the budget until Democrats come along on these agendas items. And I think that they don't want to say, because then if they go along this year, what's to say he won't come back and say, I don't know, ask for right to work statewide in a future budget? I think that they're looking down the line and saying, we don't want to set that precedent.
We just have less than a minute left, so I'll ask both of you very briefly, yes or no, do you think we're going to – what movement – do you think we're going to see movement before Memorial Day, Brian?
Oh, you're asking me to be a pundit. I have no idea, but somebody who has been following Illinois government a lot longer than I have says always bet on nothing. So I'll just defer to that person's wisdom.
Chris, I know you've gotten some notoriety for your budget beard. The last I know that you haven't. So basically, are you telling us that you haven't shaved since in 328 days is how long your beard is at this point?
I stopped shaving May 31st when the legislature adjourned without a budget, and I'm afraid I'm going to remain unshaven into June. I don't see any major compromise coming in the next 8 days, a compromise which, while it may come from the rank and file, still has to be blessed by the governor and the legislative leaders, which brings the personalities back into it again.
That's Chris Kjærgaard. He's a political reporter with the Peoria Journal Star. We tweeted out a picture of Chris's beard. Thanks to Chris and Brian Mackey. That does it for us today. I know we're going to be following all the action in Springfield all this week, so stay tuned. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo.